Brigadier Vickers, Reel 5. What impression did you gain of other Allied forces that you saw in Korea?
Well, we had... I've talked about the Norwegian Army Hospital.
Incidentally, what happened to them? What happened to them when you diverted the flow of patients away from them? What did they do? How did they fill up their days?
Good question. I think they treated a certain number of American casualties, and I think they went back and supported the Korean Army. I think. But they certainly moved from a terrible place called Weejongbu. They moved from there, and they disappeared. I think they were a bit sad leaving us. But, you know, different standards, but it was. I only met the French to begin with. They were in a very irregular collection of cutthroats, and after, just at the tail end of the Imogen battle when the Gloucesters were cut up, I did meet the French. They disappeared. They were all volunteers. They were mostly from the Algerian army, I think. Can't say much about them. We had Puerto Ricans. We had a regiment. In the November battle, when really things were getting a bit desperate, they were moved up behind us, and they certainly, by the next morning, were in the right place with the right sort of intention. I never saw them fight, but moving a regiment some 70 miles at night and deploying them at night and into the right place with not many liaison officers and guides was pretty good performance. And I must say, I was impressed to see them there the next morning when I went about my business. The Turks disliked the Americans because they'd been let down very badly at the first battle of Pyongyang, and they'd really been almost annihilated because I think the American G1 of the division involved forgot about them or something. That happened. And they formed a tremendous affinity with us. And for instance, when Anzac Day came round there, we not only had the Australians and the Kiwis and the KOSB who were Gallipoli and the Leicesters who were Gallipoli, but we had the French and the Turks on parade. And the Turkish general took the salute. And of course, this was unique, and it was an expression from marvellous party. All Turkish senior officers are apparently called Kuchuk. And I remember General Jim invited the Turkish general, who had a huge hat and a very small body, to take the salute. And the Turkish general turned round and saluted Castles and stood, and a great torrent of Turkish came out. I suppose he must have spoken for, seemed hours, but non-stop, very fast, for 3 minutes. And his chief of staff, also called Kuchuk, had been a student of mine at the staff college. And I said, "Kit, what did he say?" He said, "Thank you." I always remember that great laughter. But they were... they wouldn't go back to Tokyo for their rest and recuperation 5 days. They had tried it, and they simply couldn't fathom it. And they had none. And I ran a... At Incheon, we had two WRVS who came out, most illegally, but Lady Reading sent them out. And we started a camp there, a rest camp, where you could send people down for 2 or 3 days. And we used to send them down by platoons. And this got very popular. These two WRVS girls did it marvellously. No shortage of labour. I sent down 2 platoons of my Korean Service Corps. I started a prawn farm there. We used to fly prawns up every Friday. Hundreds of pounds of prawns and oysters and things like that. And Kuchuk came to me and talked to me about this and asked if he could put a Turkish element into the camp. And I was a bit worried. But I flew down with Kuchuk and we talked to the 2W and they said, of course. And so a little corner of the field was roped off and the Turks were put in there and they produced their own cookhouse and so on and so forth, but they used all the camp amenities and the cinema and the nappy and things like that. And I went there, I'd gone somewhere else, and I called in there, and I shall never forget, there was Cynthia Aucliffe, one of the WRVS, sitting in a chair winding wall from a Turk who was holding Ludlow, and there were five enormous Anatolian Turks sitting down on the ground watching her. And they never put a foot wrong there, and they behaved impeccably, and they really appreciated it. And I suppose we had always had 40 to 50 Turks resting there for a week, and the WIVS told them they'd do anything you asked them to do. They were huge men. Now, another thing about that, we hadn't got any funds in the division. And Jim Castles, in his own inimical way, said, I'd like you to start a divisional welfare fund and go round begging for money. So I said, very good. So I wrote to the sort of GOC in Hong Kong and the CNC Far East and the GOC Singapore-based district, the Bears people and so on and so forth, and got an absolutely astounding result. Canada produced $50,000 Canadian, just like that. Australia produced this. Singapore produced about £100,000, including the complete takings for a whole day at Singapore races, things like that. And very soon I had an enormous account. And of course, it was easy to go back. You could easily borrow a Fairchild Packet aircraft carrying 16 tons and get it loaded at Tachikawa. And I used to send a Canadian purchasing mission down to the PX in Tokyo, and we'd buy all the games you wanted with the Leafs and everything like that. And when I left and handed over, I think I had something like £200,000 in the account, which I controlled myself, and it was embarrassing. But we didn't want for anything, and if we wanted cinema projector, leap cam, you bought the best Japanese, the one for £500, no question, have a spare, have two. But I control the thing with my staff captain there, and it was entirely spent on welfare, and anything over, I think, £100, I had to sign the cheque. But, gosh, people were generous. It literally, the money poured in. And that was a very good thing. Word about the enemy? Well, you didn't see the enemy very much. But he was... when he got to close quarters, he was obviously a very formidable chap. And when we got up against the Chinese, as we did fairly soon, he really was a formidable soldier. He was very tough. I suppose he was dedicated. He didn't surrender. You had to kill him like a Japanese. I think the whole time I was there, I think we only had 7 prisoners. And they'd all been wounded. I'm not sure of those figures. But very, very few prisoners. He was an astonishing man in a night attack. The way he would get through your wire and get at you. And we found out afterwards by interrogation they might spend a fortnight cutting their way, tunnelling through the wire. And then they'd get into you. And not many people would get up through the wire because there wasn't room. But... I can remember a great pal of mine there, the Duke of Wellington, saying as a company commander, suddenly all hell was let loose, and the next thing he knew was a bloody great Chinaman with a shovel, which was sharpened like a razor blade, running amok in his company headquarters. And his company sergeant just shot him, but that bloody Chinaman got through into the company headquarters. And they were very tough. They were pretty good at concentrating their artillery, a bit slow, but once they got onto target, they stayed there, and you could get very heavily and unpleasantly shelled, which was generally a sign that they would follow it up infantry-wise. And we began to learn the technique, and you knew if they were shelling that lump of real estate, the only way they could really come in, so the whole of your victory target was put there, and frequently we stopped them in their tracks. He was apparently well fed according to his standards. He was sparsely equipped. I mean, there would be three men to a light machine gun. I was told that as a result of interrogation. One was to open the box, another one to hand the ammunition, and the third was a gunner. But he was a formidable fellow. Make no mistake about it. You had to be a tough man to stand up to it.
What was he like in defence when you were pushing forward?
I don't think his defensive artillery fire, I would say, was... I'm really outside my ground here, but I don't remember talking about the Chinese DFs coming down so much. You had to winkle him out of every hole in the ground and kill him. And he'd go on a lot. He didn't like flame at all, but he didn't run away. He was like a Japanese or a Korean. He was a tough hombre. But there were so bloody many of them. You see, the whole theatre got off on the wrong foot because the United States Air Force had total domination up to Yalu, and they said, there is simply no question the Chinese army will be able to come down here. We've taken out all the bridges. What they didn't recognise, and you can't get any supplies down to Yalu because there are no roads. What you don't realise is that if you want to attack the Commonwealth Division there and you want, say, 50,000 rounds of 105 ammunition, you get 60,000 little ping-yings. You give them each a show and say, off you go there. If you don't, your wife will be shot in there. And the ammunition appears there. It takes a bit of time. And if you break a bridge there, take it down, you've got a spare bridge nearby and you've got 2,000 people to build it. And the United States Air Force, although they had air domination, were not decisive. Neither were the United States Navy. The only thing that was decisive was artillery fire and infantry on the ground. And thank God he hadn't got an airport, because life would have been... I mean, we didn't camouflage at all. We camouflaged the forward positions against direct ground observation, but divisional headquarters was not camouflaged. You spread yourself in some comfort, why not? But if there'd been an airport, it would have been a very different thing. And of course, if the war had been mobile, it would have been much more difficult. But it wasn't. So, from that point of view, it was quite simple.
How did you get on with the liaison with the Air Force and with the Navy? Did you have anything much to do with them?
We had a lot to do with the Navy, because there was always a light fleet carrier on the western flank. And there was always a Fury squadron on call. Very good. And we used to send soldiers out there, and we had matlows to come and stay with us. And the Navy presence was there. And the CNC arrived, all dressed immaculately in white. It was marvellous to see these naval officers, quite immaculate. And they were typical sailors, Hakon Harriers, marvellous. But the Furies were there, we got to know them very well. Their pilots came and stayed with us, they knew the ground. They were very quick to react, very accurate. And if you wanted a really precise job, dive bombing job done, you sent for the Furies. The Americans with their F-80s, took rather a long time, a lot of safety precautions, but there were lots of them. But you could bring the Furies right close into you, and they knew the form. Air Force, there was very little Air Force there. What it was mostly secondment, and RAF pilots flying things like B-26 Marauders and F-86 Sabres and so on and so forth. We did have an interesting thing there. We had a South African Air Force squadron of Mustangs, and we rescued them one day because they were detached to a forward strip and got bogged down, bad weather, and had no food or anything, and we heard about this, and we arrived with three tunners with food, rum, a cook and tent like that, and there were six of them there, six pilots, and we were able to give them hot food and dry them out, and we had a good liaison with them. And then eventually they arrived from South Africa by some intergovernment agreement. We were given a dozen UDF, Unit Defence Force, lieutenants who went out to the battalions. I think they did very well. I can't say the same as their rather senior officer, liaison officer. I had to ship him out of Korea. He was a... Oh, dear. He should never have been let outside a sanatorium. He was an alcoholic of the worst possible type. But there it was. We had an Indian Army liaison officer, a lieutenant colonel, who had nothing to do, but he said, I'd like to run the mess. He ran the generals of Essex. He was a frightfully nice chap. And we used him. We used to say, now, Prem, look, we've got a problem. Could you go and look at this? And he was a Staff College trained chap, and he was delighted to get a job. And we were very fond of Prem, and he was very much part of the team. He was very Indian and very nationalistic and so on and so forth, but he was proud to be in the Commonwealth Division, and he did. You gave him a suitable job, you could be absolutely sure that he'd come back, go A to Z. We had American Air Force living with us, a delightful man called Tanner. He had a mobile forward command post with considerable radio contact and so on and so forth. And if you called in a USAF strike, Jim Tanner would control it. Whether it was B-29s from Okinawa bombing 15 miles behind you, the bombs going over you, you could hear these bloody things whistling over your head and going off perhaps 2,000 yards in front of you. We had no problems with them. We had various American liaison elements from artillery, and they lived with us, and they just got absorbed in the team. Good spirit, good morale in that.
How long would it take to get the Sea Furies over a target if you had to call them up on an emergency?
Oh, quite some time, because the carrier would be 50 or so miles off the coast, and it might be anywhere from 100 or 200 miles north or south of an east-west line. So if you've got it at the bottom of a line and 50 miles off coast, you would have to turn into wind, you would have to brief them, you'd have to bomb load up. I don't suppose they'd be away in much less than an hour. They'd have 45 minutes flying. I would think if they really hustled, you'd get them on target in 2 hours. But a pre-arranged strike, of course, you could get them in the air, and you could have alternative targets, which you marked with smoke. And by God, they used to come in, and they used to fly around very low in the valley, and you'd say to Sid Heber-Percy, who commanded them, you'd say, Sid, one red, and Sid would go up in the Fury, look at the red, and call the rest up, and they'd go straight in at the red smoke. They knew the ground very well, and they had a direct link to the guns, and the chap at the guns would say, smoke shot. And then the OP would say, smoke on target. And that was for Sid Heber-Percy, straight in. Very good. And we had intimate liaison with them. We were always exchanging visits. Very proud to have the Royal Navy there. We loved our Furies. Used to infuriate the Americans at airports. They were good, but there were only eight of them.
Observing the division in action, did you notice any serious or really important differences in national temperament between the various contingents?
When you're not in combat and you're out of the line, Australian standard of behaviour is different by our standards. The Kiwis less so. The Canadians, particularly the French Canadians, were impressive in their pride and cleanliness and soldierly bearing. The British infantryman and the British gunner was the same. If he had to be clean, he was clean. Otherwise, he was a bit scruffy, but he got in his job. No, I wouldn't say so. When it came down to the sharp end of the business, I would hate to say who were the best. The Australians were extremely good in battle. Very, very resilient. The Canadians were very good. And the British battalions, provided they had enough time to run in and get a bit of experience. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better battalion than the KOSB. You couldn't ask for a better battalion than the KSLI or the Duke of Wellington. I mean, they just did a damn good job, and you had no worries about them. No, I don't think so. I again go back to the Americans. I used to feel sorry for the Americans. If you were over down the MSR in the evening, you could see the reinforcements coming up, and I used to think, you poor little buggers, you're going to be put in the sausage machine and minced up, because they didn't rotate units. They just sent out replacements. And I think they had a bloody awful time. But they were dedicated. They felt they were fighting communism. I respect them for it. I can remember coming across a great lump of these Americans, about five truckloads. And then I had AA and QMG. One leaned over and said, "Say, bud, what's that, a pop tune or something like that?" And I stopped and talked to them, and they were astounded to find that there were British in Korea. When I said there's a whole division there, in fact, there are 20,000 soldiers, the biggest division the British Army's ever had, they wouldn't believe it. My God, they were unbriefed. They were purely American. Purely American. Nothing to do with the United Nations. And they died very easily. Living conditions in Korea. If you were lucky like the AQ, you had a caravan, which was marvellous. If you weren't, you dug a hole in the ground, and you had a thing called a space heater, which if you looked after it and kept it clean, kept you warm. If it didn't, it was rather apt to go bang with disastrous consequences. Food was marvellous. We were on British dry, an Australian oblique, American fresh. And I can remember at one messing conference, which we used to have once a month, the senior supply officer held it. Every unit had to send a message, had to send a representative, and God help them, they didn't know, to chase them up. I went to one, and I remember a dirty little Scot staying up and saying, "Yes, sir, I've got a complaint." "Who are you?" "Private McCurdy, sir, C Company, 1KOSB. "What's the trouble, McCurdy?" "There's too much turkey in the ration, sir." And if you want to give a party in the mess, I merely, the senior supply officer merely had to say to the American equivalent, "Bud, could I have an extra half dozen hands and this and so on and so forth?" And it was produced. And if we wanted anything special, all you had to do was to go to your American Air Force chap and say, "Can I have £500 lift out of Tokyo tomorrow?" "Sir, that's the flight number." And you brought a chap up from Tokyo, which you had whatever. You could live lavishly. We fed very well. Drink was a bit... drink was all right. We always had to be careful. The Americans were dry. You had to be careful the amount of spirits you've let up in the forward areas. I mean, this was on medical advice. And we rather tended to reduce the nappy ration units in contact. And when they were in reserve, they could have what they wanted. Divisional headquarters, we decided with a number of visitors that we should have what we wanted. I don't remember drinking much. It was there if you wanted it. There was plenty of rum if you wanted it. Food was excellent. Mail, settled down, was good. Cigarettes. And Americans were frightfully generous with PX packs, as they called them, which contained 5,000 cigarettes, 100 Hershey bars and things like that. And a bloody great 2.5-ton truck would drive up, and a chap would appear and say, "Colonel Pink's compliments, so he thought you'd like these," and there'd be 25 PX packs. They were very generous. And mind you, we used to send the old man down a bottle of a case of Scotch whiskey, and that was marvellous. He used to send his old granddad bourbon in return. Very friendly. Funny thing, a UN force. Van Fleet was the theatre commander when I got there, and he was very much a United Nations man, and made it so, and came round. When he came to us, he only wore one ribbon, the DSO, which he got as a divisional commander in Normandy. I'm a bit euphoric about Korea, because I felt it was the most important job I'd ever done. I had a divisional commander for whom I had the utmost respect and admiration. I had a good team. I had a happy relationship. I enjoyed it. It was bloody uncomfortable. It was bloody dangerous. One felt miles from home, but I believed in the job we were doing. And the more I did it, I knew we'd got a super division which could do anything, absolutely anything. And I had complete confidence in them. And I think they had confidence in the divisional staff. Mind you, you had to prove yourself. It took perhaps 6 months to do that. But it was a very big division. We had an additional infantry battalion. We had an additional... You had about five additional major units, and with the Koreans, we were something, our ration strength was over 24,000. A lot of people to look after, but it was all right. Mind you, it was static, so it was Rolls-Royce.
What did you do when you weren't actually working?
I'm a very keen bird watcher, and Karar is one of the three greatest places in the world for bird migration. So when it was a migratory season, I had a marvellous time. Otherwise, I used to go and see my friends in the division, things like that. I occasionally used to take a night off and go down to Seoul and have a lie-down hot bath and then breakfast and come back in the morning or fly back in the morning. But bird watching and butterflies, marvellous butterflies. And I had the local book, and I got a lot of help from an old professor in Taegu University, who I never met, but I was put in touch with him by the American Red Cross, and he told me where, when, and what to look, and I saw birds in Karar, which was marvellous. There wasn't much time off. I mean, you were working 14, at least hours a day. Lot of visitors, lot of travelling. Well, it was a very full life. Marvellous. I was as fit as hell.
Did you get any time of physical training to keep yourself?
Wasn't time. No. I did a lot of walking, particularly over some of the reserve lines to see that they were stocked. I did thousands of miles in a jeep.
What about leave? Did you manage to get away entirely on leave at all?
I wouldn't go to Tokyo because I didn't like it. And I did go. The American Red Cross arranged for me to go to Hokkaido, the old capital, where I stayed under Japanese conditions for 4 days and had a marvellous time and saw the old capital and ate Japanese food and was looked after by an old retired professor of Oriental languages from Liverpool University who wore a top hat, a tailcoat, striped trousers. And he was charming and showed me. And I had 4 days dead slow. I didn't see another European. And they couldn't have been kinder. And I was the mayor was brought to me and introduced. The chief of police was brought to me and introduced. And they put a car at my disposal. And the Americans flew me there in an amphibious aircraft. I mean, it's Rolls Royce. If you serve the Americans and you please them, they'll do anything for you. Anything. But Tokyo, I had to go there 2 or 3 times on duty to the embassy and the CNC star. I thought it was Sodom and Gomorrah rolled into one dreadful place. Didn't enjoy it at all.
What was there in Seoul at that time? Was it
It was flat. Nothing. Not many civilian inhabitants. It had been flattened. And it was chiefly... There were two main airfields at Kimpo 1 and K-16, which were just outside Seoul. There was a lot of air activity. The railway was working as far as Seoul, but south of the river. There was a UN club there, but it was, it was a shack put together. A certain amount of Sigmund Rhee, the president, lived there. A certain amount of political life. We didn't use Seoul at all. I mean, we had our advanced base camp in the northwest corner of Seoul, which was quite a big area.